You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, we are joined here in studio by Jason Kelly, chief correspondent for Bloomberg Originals and executive producer of a new podcast. It's called The Deal with Alex Rodriguez and Jason Kelly. On this week's episode of The Deal, Alex Rodriguez and Jason Kelly speak with U.S. soccer legend Brandi Chastain about private equity firm Sixth Street's sports investments and the Bay FC owner's hope for the sport. She also talks about if the world is ready for women's sports. Let's take a listen.
I honestly believe that part of the equation that wasn't in our control was the mass general public and the business sector not ready for women. Yeah. Not ready for powerful women, not ready for women with big voices who have grand ideas. We didn't have the deep pockets. And before coming here today, I think that's the one thing that kept coming into my head was I had $0 that I could be an owner with.
All right. Very good stuff. Jessica Chastain with our own Jason Kelly. Jason, thanks so much for coming in the studio. A big commute from your desk. You got a guest with you.
I know. I brought a buddy. I thought it was bring your former all-star friend to work day.
Okay. Oh, I left mine at home.
Is it? Oh, awkward. Yeah. Sorry. I remembered. I mean, I'm a good student. Yeah. A-Rod, my co-host right here with me.
Awesome. Thanks for coming in, Alex. Appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thank you, guys.
You guys have had so many cool podcasts and episodes here, speaking to some really cool people. Jessica Chastain, I think for
Brandi Chastain.
Brandi Chastain.
Different Chastain.
Yeah. Just amazing. Yeah. Kind of when you think about 1999, the World Cup, ripping the jersey off and everything, just that's such a big image. And you kind of thought, gee, maybe that would be the launch of women's soccer, at least, maybe women's sport. I'm not sure we've seen it. What'd you guys talk about?
I mean, I thought it was so fascinating, Alex, because, you know, she's an icon, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think about, like, the people who have defined sports in our lifetimes, especially in women's sports, like, nobody bigger than Brandi Chastain. And the amazing thing was that this moment in 1999 was going to be, like, the takeoff for women's sports. And it's like, womp womp. Like, it just didn't happen. It actually failed twice. And now she's an owner of a team. I was fascinated by just kind of her perspective on all that. I don't know if you were.
I thought it was great. And if you see what's happened with Caitlin Clark now, we thought that was going to happen in 99. And it kind of stalled, as Jason said. But for me, was how she's kind of going through her journey from sports to business as a sports owner and all the lessons that she's learned in sports, the hard times, the good times. She shares some incredible stories. But I'm really interested how her next decade goes because she's full. She's all in.
Can I ask? Okay, first of all, we should know. I know very little about sports, so I'm going to ask those questions.
But if you have a question about energy,
power prices. You can come to me. But why is it so hard for women's sports to take off in a material way? Is it like the type of sports we play? What's the problem, Alex? What do you think?
Well, I think Caitlin Clark has captured the imagination of everyone, and I'm old enough to remember when the NBA was on, you watch the finals on tape delay, right? It was incredible, right, to think about that. And the amount of tens of millions of people that watch today, what Caitlin Clark has done is very much what I think Magic Johnson and Larry Bird did in 1979 when, you know, Bird was at Indiana State, Magic was at Michigan State, and it was like these two Midwestern guys that captured America. I think that is now here, is true, the moment's right. I think post-COVID, the landscape of the world has changed, and I think it's been the perfect storm, and she's been the perfect ambassador. To have almost 20 million people watching, yeah, Jason, is incredible.
And by the way, more people watched the women's final this year than the men's final, first time in history. And that actually, I think, is one of the biggest points of this, is that there was long this assumption of, like, people aren't going to watch women's sports on TV. Mm-hmm. And so they just didn't put it on. I mean, shockingly, a bunch of men made a decision that people wouldn't watch women on TV. So and then what happened was they saw, and you've seen this in your investment work, Alex, what they saw was when they did put it on the air, people watched, and then it just kept building. And I think the other really interesting thing that we learned from Brandy was this idea that the investment wasn't there initially. I mean, those two leagues failed because the two previous soccer leagues for women in the U.S. failed because they tried it for like a year or two, and they're like, oh, that didn't work. Instead of, you know, you think about the NBA, you think about the NFL, those were leagues that took decades mm-hmm. to take hold. The MLS is in its like 25th, 30th season and is just getting traction. So part of it is just like putting in the time and the money.
Well, I think, you know, as a former Wall Street guy, what amazed me about this transaction, you got private equity.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Coming. Mm-hmm. Private equity is not in Major League Baseball, are they? Or
yeah,
NFL?
They are now.
They are getting there. I mean, this is a big thing that you're seeing up close and personal.
Yeah, I mean, sports have, these franchises have gotten so expensive. To think a guy like Jerry Reinsdorf bought in 1981 the White Sox for about $60 million, and 3 years later, in 84, he buys the Bulls with a guy by the name of Michael Jordan there for $19 million. Oh, it's incredible, right? And those franchises are worth close to 10 collectively today. So the world has exploded. So what's happened is individuals can't really afford to write checks for $1 billion, $2 million. It's hard to have that type of liquidity. So what the leagues have done is they've opened up the capital markets, and private equity groups like Arctos and Dio are now big investors, and they sit as LPs, while passive LPs has been an industry for the last 30 years that's gone up and to the right about 15% a year, year over year.
And this is why, Jason, you were here.
Yes.
Because you have covered private equity for a very long time. You literally wrote books on it. And then you kind of saw a while ago, like, where the direction of travel was really going.
Yeah.
What's the kind of the return, like, what's the return like on these things? Like, how, like, what do you think?
I mean, TBD.
That was a long pause, by the way, for radio.
Well, because we haven't really, you know, we've seen a couple exits. Mm-hmm. I mean, so Dial... Mm-hmm. made some money on the Phoenix Suns when mm-hmm. they were sold for $4 billion a couple years ago. So that's been one exit. I mean, what's interesting is, so Sixth Street, just speaking specifically about Sixth Street, mm-hmm. and, you know, this is started by Alan Waxman, former special situations head for Goldman Sachs, was in a partnership with TPG. You know, so they've invested $125 million. They led an investment for $125 million into Bay FC. That's real money. Paid a record franchise fee, $53 million just to buy the team. I mean, they're looking at a scenario where they can get a 5X, 10X. I mean, this is a long hold. So the franchise values, as Alex just demonstrated, I mean, think about, I mean, Jerry Jones bought the Dallas Cowboys for less than $200 million mm-hmm. in the late 80s, early 90s, which, by the way, they said he was insane. Yep. That was a crazy amount. This is a franchise now worth $9 or $10 billion.
Alex, let's talk about ownership. You're part of an ownership group for the Minnesota mm-hmm. Timberwolves, yep. right? Talk to us about that experience. And I'd love for you to talk to you about, my personal opinion is, I'm concerned about the valuation of franchises. I'm concerned about salaries because it's all predicated in large part on broadcast rights.
Yeah.
And with cord cutting, I'm not sure ESPN's going to continue to write these crazy checks. So talk to us about kind of what you've learned about as being an owner there.
It's funny because one of my good friends and mentors is Magic Johnson. And of course, he played basketball for a long time, and he owns a baseball team.
Yep.
And I played baseball for a long time, and I'm part of the ownership group of the Minnesota Timberwolves and the Lynx. You know, what I think is there's no question that the giant in sports in America is the NFL, right? And to think that, you know, almost 20 million people watch Caitlin Clark.
Yeah.
Those are NFL numbers on Sundays. I mean, that's the number one driver for all sports, and which creates a lot of people to be very bullish in women's sports. But going back to we have the links as well. But I do think that the NFL and the NBA are global sports, especially the NBA. It's growing year over year. If you look at social media as an example, as a metrics, we're almost 10 to 1 to the NFL. We're almost 15 to 1 to Major League Baseball. So LeBron James, Michael Jordan, Steph Curry, these are global names. I think that is going to be a different landscape, but you'll have more contributors. Maybe you have NBC pop in, Amazon, Apple. There's a lot of suitors. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be the traditional. So ESPN may not write as big a check, but is there, I'm not speaking for the NBA. I'm just giving you my opinion, that you may have a world where NBC may split the finals with ESPN and ABC. So I think you'll get to a similar result, just a different way.
So you said those words, and I knew those people. So I feel like I'm not qualified to ask this question. But then for someone like me, who's a newbie who maybe wants to watch some stuff, like I need like a spreadsheet to like find out like what's playing where, when, what time, like Amazon Prime, Netflix, something like that. And I wonder if that's going to be a hurdle. Jason, what do you think to like?
I mean, it could be. I mean, and Paul knows this space better than anyone. You know, there's been sort of a fracturing, but now sort of a reconsolidation, it feels like, of how we're going to consume sports. I mean, you've followed this for years. You know that live sports, Alex knows it from being on television and being broadcast himself, people love live sports, and that it's one of the only things that actually keeps people coming back to live content. I do think, though, we are in this weird world where sometimes you don't know where to find it, and yet when you do, it attracts the eyeballs.
My New York Yankees off to a great start this year.
Yes.
What's your scouting
report? You could say our New York Yankees in this room. Yes.
Off to a great start this year, and what's your scouting report of them?
Well, I think the Yankees have done a bunch of good things this year. Excuse me. One of them is they've introduced baseball people back. Yeah, if you think about the powerhouse of the Yankees, they've been built by great baseball people like Gene Michaels, Stick Michael, as they call them. You know, Lou Piniella, Billy Martin. They've gone away from that the last 4 or 5 years, and they've suffered tremendously. The fact they brought baseball people back in, they brought a much more balanced lineup, meaning, Alex, there's more lefties than righties. Historically, Yankee Stadium is better for lefties.
Really?
Last year, they had like 9 righties in the lineup, which is way too much. They've gone back to a much balanced lineup, and now they have the best 1-2 punch in the sport with Aaron Judge and Juan Soto. The challenge is, do they have enough pitching is one, and two, have they cornered themselves by bringing in Juan Soto and not have a long-term contract?
Yep, right.
When now, is he going to want the Ohtani contract for $700 million? And is he just a one-year wonder here in New York? I think he's going to have a massive year.
Yep.
The question is, can they keep him? Second question is, do they have enough pitching to win the title?
Well, let me ask you that question. We like to think, New York fans, that New York is a selling point. Everybody would love to be. If you can be a star here, you can be a star anywhere. And there's nothing better to be a star than New York City. A lot of players, I think they find it hard to play in New York. What was your experience coming to New York? I know you're a New Yorker, so you kind of know this, but some of the people you saw during your career.
No, Paul, you're exactly right. I mean, some people, you know, the kitchen's maybe a little bit too hot for some players. Yeah. And you know right away, if they're uncomfortable, it's a different place. It's the biggest media market in the world. As they say, the pinstripes are very, very heavy, and not everyone can carry them. Juan Soto is obviously one that is going to play and play really well. Aaron Judge, the Jeters of the world, they're icons for life because they won here in New York. But some, I mean, they melt into the sun. I mean, you've seen a couple over the last 4 or 5 years that were a shell of themselves, and you quickly have to pivot and get them out of here.
Yep.
One interesting thing on that note. First of all, we talked to Michael Strahan about that on a previous episode of The Deal. One person we are literally going to tape with today, it's one of the reasons Alex is in the building, is Stephen A. Smith.
Oh.
And he's actually talked about Soto and like the power of the pinstripes maybe enough to lure him in to stay. Yeah. So tune into that episode of The Deal coming up in a few weeks.
Because
Stephen A., he's got literally some takes. That's his whole job. That's what he does.
And what a career.
So this is really cool. Like, what you guys do is super fun. Jason comes in and he talks about it. You can tell he's like totally digging this. What's it like to work with Jason Kelly? How do you manage that guy? Like, what is
the ego, the diva?
Alex, we already made a deal this morning because we are, you know, he's covered private equity. He's a great writer. So I say he writes and I use the bat. So I hit, he writes, and we make a good team. But no, Alex, in all seriousness, is really the intersection of Jason's career, mostly here at Bloomberg, and my career, mostly with the Yankees. And the fact is, what we're talking about is exactly both. And we live in a world where it used to be sports and media and culture. Now all three have come together. And that's what we try to take away. And then also a lot of lessons learned in this world of Shark Tank, where young people want to be more entrepreneurs than athletes.
Yeah.
Right? And that's, I think we're serving up and teaching and hoping inspiring through storytelling a lot of great
lessons. And I like what you guys do, kind of bringing sports, entertainment, you know, all that together. And we're seeing it actually now in college sports with the NIL, the transfer portals. A lot of these kids are able to monetize their value.
Totally.
But there's some downside to that, it seems like. If you talk to, you know, Coach Jay Wright at Villanova, or maybe even Coach K, who I'm going to see today down at Duke, or some others, they're saying, boy, I'm not sure, maybe we've gone too far. What do you think, Alex, about what's happening in the college ranks about paying some of these athletes?
It's a very dangerous road. It's a very dangerous and very slippery. Mm-hmm. And the reason why, I love that players are getting, you know, the finances and all of that, but maybe there's a structure where there's more parity. Maybe there's a structure where kids don't get the money when they're not ready for it, and they get in trouble by not knowing how to pay taxes. And is this more of a liability than an asset? I'm all for somebody getting market value, but is there a world that we can, you know, hold until they're 30 or 35 until they get the majority of that, where that money's compounding for them? So gift and the curse. And the other part is that I'm concerned is we want to teach. Coach K is one of my great friends and one of the great, great personalities in all of sports. You want athletes to be around Coach K for 3 or 4 years, not just one.
Great point.
So, and same thing with Calipari and all of that. So we want to teach these kids that, you know, the power of restriction, and to be able to wait a little bit before they get, you know, the marshmallow, as they say.
Before we let you go, and this is a question we ask everybody. So, hey, why not you? What are you going to buy now? What are you like?
Like, this is a question we ask the portfolio manager.
So let's ask you.
Got a lot of investments.
Yeah, so what do you like?
You know, that is a great question. I mean, I'm so excited about the Minnesota Timberwolves and the Lynx. And we've done a lot of good work over the last 3 years. We've been in first place for most of the year, only two games remaining. So we're sound to make, poised to make a good run, hopefully in the postseason. But look, I think you wake up every day, you're prepared, you're ready for opportunities. That's exactly how the opportunity of the Timberwolves came up and the Lynx. So the answer is, I don't know, but we're always looking.
What are you guys going to ask Stephen A? I can't imagine. This thing could get heated quickly.
Stephen A.
You know, I mean, what I'm really interested in with him is the business of Stephen A. You know, I mean, because he's a game changer in so many ways. You know, we both had a chance to read his book ahead of this. I mean, this is a guy who completely reshaped the business of sports media by sheer force of will. Got knocked down a bunch. He had a great mentor in Mark Shapiro, another upcoming guest on the deal. I'm just touting all of our guests here. It's what I do.
Shameless plug.
That's my middle name. But, you know, for Stephen A., I think we don't know where it's going to go. We know he doesn't like the Dallas Cowboys.
Well, he doesn't, and he does love the Yankees. And I just say, in conclusion with Stephen A., it's really a story of rags to riches, but it hasn't been straight up and to the right. I mean, to think, most people forgot this. Reading his book, I just remembered, he got fired from ESPN. He had to go to Fox Radio. And then he's come back. And to think, not only is he going to be the first guy that makes, person that makes over probably 20 to 25 million, but he's also could be the next Johnny Carson. And he's built an incredible business. And I can't wait to ask
him. And Michael Strahan, talk about another amazing career coming in, in entertainment. All right, guys, thanks very much. Podcast. It's called The Deal with Alec Rodriguez and Jason Kelly. On this week's episode of The Deal, Alex Rodriguez and Jason Kelly speak with U.S. soccer legend Brandi Chastain about private equity firm Sixth Street Sports Investment and the Bay FC owner's hope for the sport. She also talks about if the world is ready for women's sports. So take a listen to that good stuff.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
recall Amazon had a letter out today.
Yeah, this is something new.
Is that a thing we do?
No, I think we start doing it now with Mr. Jassy.
Mm-hmm, okay. I mean, do we care about Amazon letters? Is that something that,
well,
I don't know.
They're so big, and it's retail, it goes to the consumer. It's now, they're a tech behemoth. Mm. They're now a huge advertising place. So I think the answer is yes. And so let's check in with an expert, Poonam Goyal, senior U.S. retail analyst for Bloomberg in Intelligence. She joins us from our Princeton offices down there in the swamps of New Jersey. Poonam, what did you make of this letter? I mean, I think Mr. Jassy is trying to just make sure that the market doesn't take its attention away from the fact that Amazon is, in effect, an AI play.
That is part of the story, definitely. I think the focus on the letter goes into all its businesses, starting with retail, where they continue to push the envelope on value and driving that GMV higher through its logistics platform, where they're improving same-day delivery and really taking costs out of the equation as much as they can. On the AWS side, AI is the name of the game, and they want to make sure that they are visible, that they are playing in that space, and that is going to improve every part of their business, not just AWS alone.
So, but in terms of AWS, it feels like what they were saying is that AWS is going to be the foundation for all the AI plays. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, you know, where AI is built is going to be inside of AWS for Amazon. They're going to be building, or you could call it the raw materials of the codes, and really providing that as an entry point for businesses that use AWS and even within their own businesses to create the efficiencies and the speed that's needed to operate in the agile environment we live in today and compete with OpenAI.
You know what I've learned since moving down to the Jersey Shore is Central New Jersey and Southern New Jersey is like a warehouse capital of the world, it seems like. Everywhere you go, and Poonam lives around there.
Is it all Amazon or just in general?
It's everything. It's everything, but tons and tons of Amazon, because you get the park, the Garden State Parkway, you got the New Jersey Turnpike, Philadelphia Port, New York Port. I think it's all there. It's just amazing. So, Poonam, I mean, talk to us about, do investors that you talk to, do they still want Amazon to invest aggressively in their retail operations there? Is there more to go there? And do investors, are they okay with that, given that maybe some of those dollars could be to the cloud, or maybe Amazon has got so much money they can invest in anything they want?
I mean, I think they need to invest in both the cloud and retail. I don't think you want them to stop investing in retail, because remember, Paul, as the retail business grows, which we estimate the GMV to grow to $1 trillion in the next coming years, that impacts their advertising business, right, which has grown to nearly $50 billion today. The bigger retail gets, the more money they can get for advertising too. So there is a connection here, and that's how retail is made profitable.
What also is interesting, aside from retail, is what they said about their Amazon Prime video. They seem to think it could be its own standalone, like good enough to live on its own. What did you make of that?
I thought that was interesting. You know, Amazon Prime Video, we know that it's something that they've been investing aggressively in, but I think the game changer here really is going to be advertising again, where as they implement ads within the Prime videos, that's what's going to take it to be profitable, whenever that is. We haven't run the model yet, but we think there's still a bit of time before you can say that Prime Video on a standalone entity is going to be profitable.
Paul, do you do Prime Video?
I'm going to just say yes. I mean, you know what I do periodically, and maybe I'll do it on the plane ride down today, is I just go through and I delete them all. You know, I just periodically go and just delete, like, I don't need this right now. I mean, you know, because it's so easy to delete these as opposed to trying to disconnect from Verizon or Comcast, which takes like a half a lifetime.
That's true.
That.
100%. And then there's weird fees and it doesn't work and the whole thing.
Hey, Poonam, what's the investment call on Amazon these days? I'm looking at the stock here. It's up 22% year to date. It's up over 80% over the trailing 12 months. So it's really performed well. We're just under $2 trillion in market cap. When you talk to investors, kind of, why do people own it today? Why do people buy it today?
We think it's all about profitability. For the longest time, for over two decades, Amazon was about market share gains and top line gains. Today, we're starting to see the story turn into a profit play. So as AWS climbs to over $200 billion in revenues, which we expect, as the GMV for its online business climbs to over $1 trillion, and as advertising gains scale to over $100 billion, you're talking about the profitability of this company improving vastly. Just last year, you know, the profits improved to about over 6% from 2% the year before that. So we're starting to see that play out. And we think the road ahead is still very clear in terms of how they parse out their way to be even more profitable.
Poonam, before we let you go, usually the reason why we like the Jamie Dimon letter is because we get really great macro reads and like calls on rates and opinions about the Fed. Did we get any of that from Annie Jassy in terms of like consumer outlook, how their end user, me, how I'm doing in the market?
Well, they talked a little bit about value and how they continue to really focus on low prices, which they had done in 4Q with Prime Day. And they also launched earlier this year a Spring Day sale. So we do see that push on value, which tells us that the consumer cares about prices. So they are being sensitive to that and responding to that. And we don't expect that to change as the year unfolds.
I tell you, if I were an investor here, it'd be for this reason. Free cash flow in 2023, $32 billion. Nice.
Wow.
How about 2024? $63 billion is the forecast.
Oh,
and in 25, $83 billion of free cash flow. So growth in free cash flow. Poonam, what do they do with the free cash flow?
They're going to invest it back in the business, right? As you said it, they still need to invest in AI, they need to invest in AWS, and they need to invest in logistics. So that will be the primary drivers of their cash investments.
But how, I guess, is the question, right? Like, they can't go buy stuff, can they? Because of all the regulatory scrutiny over big tech in that way? I mean, they can't just go buy TikTok, for example.
No, I don't. I think it'll be much harder for them to make an acquisition. They have to grow organically, and they have to invest in their own businesses. That said, there's plenty of opportunity for them to invest in what they own, whether it's across advertising, Prime Video, their retail business, and AWS. There's still a long runway for them to go. Digital commerce alone is just at 25% penetration in the U.S. and probably a little over that globally. So there's opportunity across all of their businesses, even their biggest business.
Yeah, I mean, they're spending, you know, $60 billion a year in capital expenditures. So it's not like they're, you know,
not kinda, doing anything.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. All right, Poonam, thanks so much for joining us there. Poonam Goyal, senior U.S. Retail analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us from our studios down in Princeton, New Jersey.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
We also cover Bloomberg Big Take Stories. And that's when we take a broad look at some of the major trends in the market. We dive deep. And they're really amazing stories and they're worth a ton of work. And the one today blew my brain. And for a mother of a daughter who's 9.5, I gotta tell you, I love this story. This has to do with basically your return on investment for Ivy League colleges, private colleges, mini Ivies, public schools, etc. And it's very different from what you may think. Joining us now are the personal finance reporters in charge of this story, Paulina Cicero and Francesca Maglioni, joining us now live in our Interactive Broker studio. Ladies, first of all, how did you come up with this? I would never have thought of sort of putting a Bloomberg angle ROI of college in this particular light. How did you guys together come up with it?
Yeah, so we had been talking to a bunch of families, college counselors, parents and kids that were nervous about getting into college, thinking about the cost of college, thinking, is it even worth it? And we kind of wanted to give people a number to answer their question. Like, yes, everyone says college is overwhelmingly worth it, but like, how does that change depending on the school that you're looking at and the kind of institution that you're thinking of attending? So we kind of wanted to give people a tool to answer that question a little bit more,
yeah,
I guess, in a smart way.
Francesca's done a lot of great reporting tracking just how much colleges cost, especially elite institutions. She wrote a great story about how colleges today, the elite colleges that most students want to get into, the costs are stretching past $90,000.
Oh, Paul knows. Paul knows. Intimately aware. Uh-huh.
And so when you think of those costs, I think a lot more families are being forced to consider, like, what is the ROI? And they've been doing these calculations themselves. So we wanted to, you know, crunch the numbers for them.
Of the four kids of mine that who I've paid for, Penn State was the best value. Mm. It was a relative to everybody else, way low.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got one of the best engineering schools, and the numbnuts got a great job, and you know, aerospace engineering, doing all kinds of crazy stuff. So it makes sense to me. I think one of the parts of the story that's interesting is just generally, is
college in general worth it relative to where else you could go, maybe go to a trade school and come out with little to no debt and still get jobs, and that ROI looks very interesting. I mean, how do you guys think about that?
Yeah, so we actually, like in our story, did look at what would the ROI be of someone who graduated from high school. So someone making $10 an hour would have an ROI of about $191,000 10 years after, you know, when normal college graduates enroll. And to put that into perspective, the average ROI for all colleges was about $98,000. So you can see how, you know, initially it might seem like beneficial, but that's because when you're going to college, you know you're paying for college, you're putting in that investment. But you know, once you graduate, college graduates do tend to have higher earnings, so it does balance out in the longer term.
So Francesca, help me understand the different buckets that you guys looked at and sort of the data that you found.
Yeah, so we wanted to understand what types of schools were doing better than others, and so we grouped schools by the Ivies, which obviously overperformed, as they do always. And then we looked at private elite institutions, which were a group of 63 schools that are any school that you would think of is competitive, selective, Vassar, Oberlin, Wake Forest, those kinds of schools. Mm-hmm. Then we looked at public flagship institutions and other public and elite, other public and private schools. And what we found was that after you look at the Ivies, the private elite institutions and the public flagships kind of perform the same at the 10-year mark. And that was, I think, our most surprising finding, because we feel like a lot of people put a lot of emphasis on prestige when thinking about college, and we're kind of trying to tell them, wait, maybe a public college that accepts most of its applicants can give you that same ROI.
So how about, what's the impact, I guess, or on your ROI calculations from what major you take?
That's a good question.
You know, engineering, good. Business, I would think, good.
The same idea is, like, you go to Oberlin, it's a liberal arts education, right? Like, that's humanities, psychology.
So how does that play into philosophy? The math, I guess?
Yeah, so we did tend to find that major plays a huge role in ROI. Schools where a majority of their graduates came from STEM fields tended to overperform well, and there are actually some surprise winners when you look at our ROI list. Schools like the Colorado School of Mines, the St. Louis Pharmacy Academy, and many more schools that have a STEM focus were doing just as well as some Ivies, or even better than other Ivies as well.
So what is it? I wonder if what this really tells us is that if you major in humanities, your ROI stinks. Like, is this like what we're learning? Unless you do that at an Ivy, because then you have the certain types of connections, et cetera, and you may get a better job. Other than that, is that the problem? Francesca's sort of laughing at me. I don't know what that means.
I mean, it's hypocritical of me to say I studied visual and media studies.
Girl, I was a theater director. We're all good.
But I guess if you just look at the data and you're paying a hefty sticker price for college, then yes, it's strategically the most, I guess, smart way to go about it is to study STEM, because these jobs put you directly into the labor market and are really high paying careers. If you look further down the line, these liberal art colleges do tend to get better earnings, but it's more of a long run than it would be if you're like really want to see those earnings right away.
So you guys, go ahead, please.
Oh, sorry. One thing I wanted to note is that with the rise of artificial intelligence, there has been a lot of discussion about how the critical thinking skills associated with a liberal arts degree, you know, might actually be more advantageous in the labor market later down the line, but we don't know what that is. So this is a snapshot of a point in time, probably the last 10 years. So
you know, I see you look at like one of the schools, the big state schools, the University of Georgia. You think about a big school like that, you know, one of the advantages is they have a big alumni network. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the state schools in general, how did they kind of rank in general? Because there are some really, really good state schools, whether it's, you know, Virginia or Michigan or any of those kinds of things.
Yeah, the state schools did really well. I think what's driving their ROI to be higher than many elite private schools is that they're just cheaper to attend. And at the end of the day, like Paulina mentioned at the beginning, paying $90,000 for college is just going to set you back in terms of ROI. You're going to be the earnings are going to take longer to level out. And so public schools in this instance tend to overperform because of that.
And one of the sources that we talked to went to the University of Georgia and is now working as a credit analyst at Blackstone. And one of the things that he mentioned was he knew he was someone who was ambitious and driven and was going to put the work in, that he think he had the same outcome as people who did go to these elite colleges. So sometimes it is very individual dependent if you're mm-hmm. willing to put in the work and you're really ambitious.
Right.
And
says the Duke graduate.
Yeah, very
oh,
nice.
That's
got that too. I'm flying down this afternoon down to Duke. So,
but and that just makes the point that like if you want humanities, like maybe sort of the public institutions yeah. where you can get cheaper, but also get that humanity education. I'm wondering, and you're right. It all like the drive for sure. Like that's going to depend. That's why I keep telling my kid. Like I'm like it's. It's okay, like, I know. But it's like, grades are important for sure, you gotta get into a school, but like, your ability to be a human is also more important. She did draw the whole, hey, do I have to go to college thing the other night? Out of like, nowhere. And I was like, yeah, you do. I thought you said it didn't matter, and I was like, no, it didn't. I said it didn't matter where you went. Are you guys gonna do this for New York City public versus private schools? Because I would really appreciate that ROI, please.
Yes, exactly.
They're not even.
All right, so
I don't know if the data is available. So.
All right, what's the biggest surprise that you guys had from your work here?
The biggest surprise, I think that, you know, there's a lot of intangible benefits that people think of when going to a prestigious school. This alumni network, this idea that it'll open doors and help you, you know, climb the economic ladder. And I think what was surprising is that people felt, even with all that, and acknowledging that they did get those when they went to the prestigious schools, that, you know, it's still the cost of that college kept them from achieving the things in life that they thought really mattered, like being able to start a family, mm-hmm. Owning a home, even being able to buy a car. One of the people we spoke with said his student loan payments have been more than his rent and have been since he graduated. Yep. So
I believe it.
I think I'm going to have this conversation with my daughter about helping out with a home purchase. I think that's coming Monday.
Is that coming?
I think
soon?
That's coming Monday. She yeah. asked me to go to lunch. So oh, I think that's
kind I see. Because also, like, priorities change.
Yeah.
Like, your priority that you're going to yeah. have when you're 18 is different when you're 30. Like,
exactly.
It's a holistic thing. I love the story. I'm like all into
yeah, great.
It. Thank you so much.
USC
for writing it.
And Duke. So, some pretty good schools there. You guys feel like it was good, worth it?
Yeah.
See?
Yeah. They did pretty decent ROI wise. So,
yes.
That was a relief.
Okay. All right, Francesca, thank you very much. Francesca Maglione and also Paulina Cicero, thank you very much. I highly recommend that you do private versus public in New York City. Thank you. Next assignment. Good job. You can check out that article. It's The Big Take. Definitely check that out. It is definitely worth reading if you have a kid or any grandkids or anything. It is worth talking about. This is Bloomberg.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Let's talk about the food and beverage business a little bit. Constellation Brands, they are a $50 billion market cap company based in Victor, New York. And they reported some numbers here today. So let's break it down with Ken Shea, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Consumer Products Analyst. Ken, remind everybody what Constellation Brands is. What are the big brands that they have and how's business going?
Yeah, hi, Paul. Well, Constellation Brands is well known for its line of Corona beers.
Nice.
And increasingly Modelo, part of that family. It also makes Woodbridge wines, High West whiskey. pretty much a portfolio of beer, wine, and spirits brands, but again, mostly skewed towards beer.
So how'd they do? Walk us through more stuff.
So the quarter, you know, I think the backdrop, first of all, was for a slow quarter, you know, for most wine and beer companies right now and spirits. Given some recent results from Brown-Forman and Duckhorn Portfolio, they're a producer of wines, where they're all saying, you know, trade inventory reductions stemming from cooling demand across all alcoholic beverages was kind of the backdrop to this earnings report. So when it came out, it beat expectations. Beer sales were up 11%. Wine and spirits were weak, but again, this is mostly a beer company. And so that's why it was perceived very positively, because, you know, this was a dose of good news and otherwise very cautious market. So the company's doing basically what it said it would do. You know, it had good results for beer. It reduced debt some more. It's committed to expanding its big brewery operations down in Mexico, increased the dividend 13%. So from a shareholder point of view, they're doing the things they said they would do, and the beer results beat expectations, and that gave the market a dose of good news today.
Stock hitting a 52-week high today, up about 10.6% year-to-date, up about 19% over the past 12 months. What's the growth story here? Let's go another way. What's Constellation saying about the consumer in general? Because you know, there's a lot of concern out there as we look at some of the big data coming out of Washington, D.C. about the consumers, as inflation and all that type of stuff. What are they seeing?
Well, they look at the paper also. They understand, you know, the environment that they're in, that the consumer has definitely turned a little cautious here towards purchases that they can defer. I guess that's the best way to put it. You know, beer is, you know, a relatively low price point product vis-a-vis wine and spirits, you know, a high-end bottle of wine or high-end bottle of bourbon. You can maybe put off for a while, but, you know, a bottle of beer or even a six-pack, whatever, you're not as prone to do that. Even though Corona and Modelo, you know, command a very premium price, it's a premium product. So they're aware that they can't just keep, you know, tacking on big price increases. They're aware of what's going on. But they see the consumer as resilient, particularly for beer right now.
So, Ken, when we get you on, we like to talk about all the things. And one of the things we like to talk about is weed, because you walk down the street in New York City, you get the wafting. I mean, I think it smells good.
Right. Let's clarify this, that Ken covers the cannabis stocks as well.
Yes.
It's not that he is a
maybe does the
connoisseur of the weed.
Right.
He's not our
distributor. You're right. I did not frame this correctly. Ken, you're an analyst that also covers the cannabis stocks. When I walk around in New York City, I smell a lot of cannabis products. How are these companies actually doing?
Well, Alex, they're doing pretty well from a sales point of view, from an EBITDA point of view. But, you know, the taxation on cannabis companies is so onerous, and not very many are profitable from a GAAP accounting point of view. So if you're an investor in this market, you certainly have to be patient, and that's because you need some help from regulators, from Washington, whether it's a reclassification from, you know, a prohibited drug like marijuana is considered today, or it's outright legalization in some states and so on. So you need some help from regulators to keep this thing going. So it's going at a sales are, from an industry point of view, are moving positively as more states legalize. You know, Florida, it's going to be on the ballot. Florida could be a $6 billion legal market, or about three times the size that it is now, in a very short order, if in November voters approve legalization for adult use in November. So it's moving positively, but again, from an accounting point of view, you know, it's not looking as rosy.
So what's this? You cover a lot of the consumer companies, Ken, from the beverage companies to the beer companies and packaged goods. What's the sector that's doing the best here? Where's the most investor interest these days?
You know, good old soft drinks. Yep. Non-alcoholic soft drinks, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, you know, Keurig Dr. Pepper, Celsius Energy. You know, people love their soft drinks, and it's a very, very resilient market. It's doing well, whether it's at food service or it's, take home for home consumption, doing very well. And that's where the pricing power is at. You know, you're looking at categories like energy. Energy is no longer an upstart category. It's a $20 billion category. It's a big category, right? But it's still growing at high single-digit rates, and it's no sign of slowing down. Even the carbonated beverages, you know, Coke, Pepsi, the products have been around a long time. I think they're discovering that maybe they were underpriced for a long time because they've been taking pricing up for a while. Consumers are not balking at all. As a matter of fact, those mini cans have far higher unit prices than the regular size, and consumers love them.
I like that.
So that's an area of particular strength right now.
Mini can's nice.
Yeah,
it doesn't get flat if you don't drink the whole thing.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, Ken, the non-alcoholic spirit thing, does that have real legs? John Tucker, don't say anything. We only have a minute.
I think it does, you know, to a small audience. I mean, this reminds me of the Liquid Death water. You know, it's basically spring water in a can. It's called Liquid Death.
Yep.
People like to act like, you know, or not act, but they like to be social at parties. And, you know, it's a certain vibe that's given off if you're drinking a bottle of, you know, plain bottled water as opposed to something that looks cool, like Liquid Death, even though it's by and large the same ingredients inside. So same can be said for non-alcoholic beverages. I may make a little joke of this, but I think younger demographics tend not to imbibe in alcohol as much as maybe my generation did, and I think that's part of the attraction as well.
All right, Ken, we got to leave it there. Thanks a lot, Ken Shea, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Consumer Products Analyst. I tried all that stuff because I don't really drink that much anymore, and then I'm like, why not just drink juice? And it's all that sugar anyway. Anyway.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.